On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we talk a bit about gender equality in the workplace, Infineon's crypto flaws, and we have a great guest, Ray Pompom of F5 Labs, who will take us on a deep dive into phishing attacks. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 262, recorded October 20th, 2017. Fishers of Men.
This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so that you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise.
Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I am your host for today, Louis Maresca, your guide through the world of enterprise. But as you know, this enterprise world is a pretty massive place. And in order to represent it correctly, I need to pull in another expert or a master of their domain. My co-host in crime, Mr. Brian Chi, the director of Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Chibert, I hear you're having a bit of open house over there today.
Yes, we are. And so periodically through the show, you might hear a muffled explosion in the background. We are demonstrating the explosive gas effects in volcanic volcanism. And Dr. Julia Hammer and her Hammer team will be showing it off and using lots of liquid nitrogen for the chat room and so forth. Sorry for people on download. I'm going to be pasting in a YouTube link into the chat room if you want to see some footage that I shot a couple years back.
I love liquid nitrogen, and that's all I'm going to say. But so we have a great show for today. We talk a little bit about gender equality in the workplace, of course, Infineon's crypto flaws that we've been hearing about, and also we have a great guest, Ray Pompom from F5 Networks, who will take us in deep dive into phishing attacks and how tactics are evolving and what attackers are looking for. But first, of course, as we always do, let's jump into the blips. In the past several weeks, Google Security has at it again, releasing a set of seven critical vulnerabilities with the proof of concept exploit code from a highly popular service called DNS Mask. Now, it is out in the wild right now, but we will have to see how long it takes for hackers to actually exploit it. As you know, WannaCry took about 24 days for disclosure, from disclosure to attacking tens of thousands of backdoored machines. Eternal Blue was released on January 7th, along with the Lost in Translation leaks. And by April 7th, there was 1.7 million hosts infected by the double Pulsar backdoor. How does this relate to DNS Mask? Well, as of October 11th, there are a total of 1.17 million devices running vulnerable versions of DNS Mask. If we take into account the long patch management cycles in the enterprise and a massive number of Android devices that are out there of support this situation, it could potentially be a global impact. Shodan, which is actually an internet-connected device search engine, continually shows the vulnerability of devices with the affected versions of DNS Mask as it grows over time. Although it only has been a couple days, let's hope the vulnerability has fallen to deaf ears until device patches can be normalized. Is that wishful thinking?
Hey, Clyde Wright, do you want 10 gig speeds on your cable modem? I sure do. Cable internet with download and upload speeds of 10 gigabits per second may eventually come to American homes thanks to a new specification for a higher speed symmetrical data transmissions. The industry's R&D consortium, Cable Labs, today announced that it has completed the full duplex data over cable service interface specification and update to DOCSIS 3.1. The completion of the 10 gigabits per second full duplex spec comes 18 months after the project was unveiled. The completion of the spec doesn't mean you'll suddenly be getting multi-gigabit uploads and downloads, as commercial deployments may be at least a couple of years away and may not initially provide the maximum speeds allowed by the spec. What does this mean if you purchased your existing cable modem? Well, keep an eye on the market for advertisements and early adopter offerings for soon-to-be-emerging DOCSIS 3.1 updated compatible cable modems to feed your need for speed.
Some of you are familiar with the difficult task of having to design and or produce a design and then taking that design to actual code. It's not easy, right? Well, there are workflows out there, but normally they're decoupled and have separate steps in the process. Well, a Copenhagen-based startup called UiZard Technologies thinks it has the answer for this process. It leverages the latest developments in the field of machine learning to build a neural network that, once fed with the raw screenshots of the graphical user interface, proceeds to automatically generate the code. Calling it Pix2Code, the machine learning models have the capacity to produce for three different platforms, including Android and iOS, as well as other web-based technologies. How accurate are these models? Well, at this point, they are actually 70% or actually 77% accurate at taking images to code. The most intriguing thing is that UiZard is posting the source code of the app as open source on GitHub. It seems that tools like these are essentially lowering the barrier of entry for app development, and it continues to lower as we build more and more of these. Let's just hope that it doesn't produce more fart apps in the store.
Fart? Really? Well, hey, that Wi-Fi connected plug buried behind your couch could become a bot to attack you. Billions of Internet of Things devices exist in offices and homes around the world, including everything from sensors and home assistants to connected children's toys. But many producers of IoT devices have rushed out products with almost no thought put into cybersecurity. Not only has this resulted in data breaches as a result of IoT products with weak security, but also ended up with connected devices being roped into botnets and used to carry out DDoS attacks or being used as an entry point for hacking into wider networks. What this really means is that we're going to need to be a lot pickier about what kinds of IoT devices we let into our homes. To really illustrate just how fast some of these products have been shoved onto the market is illustrated by folks like SimpliSafe, who let an early release out the door with hard-coded passwords. Well, or how millions of IoT devices were used in a botnet attack to take down some major DNS players earlier this year. Considering a huge number of inexpensive IoT devices are being marketed with ancient Linux kernels, you begin to get the impression that perhaps the buyer really needs to beware.
So no one likes to hear about high-profile companies and possible negligence in their security out in the wild, but it is a common held belief among many companies, large and small, that security isn't taken seriously or dismissed as unimportant compared to other companies. Unfortunately, a report from this past week based on a leak recording from Facebook, the security chief has told employees that the social media giant needs to improve its internal security practices to be more like a defense contractor. In the recording, Alex Stamos made the comments to employees in an internal meeting conducting this year, arguing that the company hadn't done enough to respond to the growing threats that company faces, citing both technical challenges and cultural issues at the company. Some quotes from that meeting: "The threats that we are facing have increased significantly, and the quality of our adversaries that we are facing is also increasing," he said. "Both technically and from cultural perspective, I don't feel like we've caught up with our responsibilities. The way I explain to management is that we have the threat profile of Northrop Grumman, or Raytheon or another defense contractor, but we run on our corporate network. We run on our corporate network, for example, like college campus almost," he said. Stamos also added, "We have an intentional decisions to make to give access to data and systems to engineers to make them move fast, but that creates our issues for us as well." We'll have to see in the coming months how this leak affects the way Facebook is, as well as its users, and how they think about security.
So consumers may finally have an easier way to dive into multi-factor authentication. Google announced this last Tuesday a program for high-risk users, an easier way to use multi-factor authentication. So you no longer have to be part of an enterprise security system to lock up your personal information on Google. Just buy a pair of FIDO Universal Two-Factor Authentication Dongles, aka U2F, off someplace like Amazon. Sadly, when I tried to buy the Bluetooth version off Amazon on Tuesday morning, it was listed as unavailable, making me think maybe their developers are making sure they're not affected by the recent Infineon vulnerability. Gladly, it was available the next day. The gist is that if you have to make your information harder to get to by using something you know, a password, and something you have, the dongle, it will dramatically increase the security of the Google system for higher risk users like doctors, lawyers, politicians, journalists, and financiers, to mention a few. Just don't lose your dongles, because as The as yet to be determined process to unlock your account could be intrusive, cumbersome, and potentially take days to unlock.
So let's end the blips on some good notes. There have been several forcing functions like companies like Google to have the latest version of their software and browsers support only secured HTTPS sites. Well, based on a recent report, it seems like it's working. 64% of Chrome traffic on Android is now protected, up to 42% from a year ago. In addition, over 75% of Chrome traffic on both Chrome OS and Mac is now protected, up from 60% on Mac and 67% on Chrome OS about a year ago. And Windows traffic is up to 66% from 51%. Google also noted that 71 of the top 100 websites now use HTTPS by default, up from 30% a year ago. And then in the US alone, HTTPS usage in Chrome is up from 59% to 73%. With the decline in cost to get certs and secured endpoints using HTTPS, we're all about hoping that at some point an insecure browser setting will be eradicated from this earth. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. And before we get into the bites, we'll have to tell you about our great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And Padre wants to tell you about it. Padre?
Thanks, Siebert. Thanks, Lou. We'll get back to the action in just a bit. But first, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, let me ask you a question. Do you like the mortgage process? I mean, it's fun, right? Burying your life, bringing in boxes of receipts, making sure that you've got all of your pay stubs so that someone in a bank who's a rando can decide whether or not you are worthy of a loan. Well, of course, you don't like it. Nobody likes it because we are modern people. And we expect modern conveniences like an all-digital mortgage process. That's why we're so happy to have Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans as a sponsor of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, Rocket Mortgage understood that there was something wrong with the mortgage process. It just wasn't keeping up with the times. It was dated. It needed a client-focused technological revolution. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. No more boxes of receipts, no more old pay stubs, no more carbon copies that you try to make sense of your financial history. It's all there with just a click. Now, based on your income, your assets, and your credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of your home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that's just right for you. That means whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds and get you the mortgage that fits your lifestyle, not the other way around. It's Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. That's rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Equal housing lender license in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now back to the action with Lou and Siebert and Twyatt.
So, you know, gender equality in the workforce is something that many organizations are striving for and they're trying to improve. But the question is, are we really doing enough? So let's talk a little bit about facts first. We take the global gender gap rankings, and currently the United States is still ranked at 45th in the list, with a surprising Iceland coming at the top, Finland, Norway, and Sweden, but with other global companies like Russia being at 75, China at 99, and Japan at 111. On average, in the United States, every $1 you earn as a male, a woman actually earns only 65 cents. In the United States, the average annual salary for a woman is about $43,000, and for a man, it's actually $66,000. And the global average earnings for 11 is around 11K for a female versus 20K for a male. In the United States alone, 66% of women are part of the labor force, and compared to the 77% of men as well. In the global workforce, there's roughly about 1.75 billion females and about 2.62 billion males. And a recent article about the topic surveyed a pool of females in the global workforce and found that women in European markets mirror the same concerns as the U.S. market, and that there are too few women studying science and technology in school, and there are gender bias in the workplace. There is an obvious gap, but what is adding to the challenge is the continual stream of harassment and gender bias that's surfacing from such higher profile companies. The reports of these topics keep stacking on and on. just recently, Susan Fowler of Uber wrote a detailed blog post about a harassment and retaliation as part of that of her professional career, as well as Ellen Poe recently decided to fight back against her venture capital firm, Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers, for being discriminated against and got poor reviews, resulting in her dismissal. Not only are there more of these cases coming out more and more, but there's also a backlash to the movement, such as James Altizer. He's 52. He's an engineer at NVIDIA, and he declared in a recent Times article that the feminists in Silicon Valley had formed a cable whose goal was to subject men. Unfortunately, that continues to go on. But there's also comments such as from Lori McVitie of F5. According to the study from Center of Work-Life Policy, 56% of technical women leave their job at the mid-level point, more than double the quit rate of men. One-third of women surveyed the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee said that they left the tech industry because companies were not flexible enough to accommodate an adequate work-life balance. Chibert, are companies just not doing enough here? Is this going to continue to happen? Are we going to hear more and more about this?
I think we're starting to see a backslide. Long, long ago, when I interviewed with IBM Global Services, I was sent a potential hire package, and the employee benefits package looked like an annual report. It was glossy. It was thick. There was a huge emphasis on a work-life balance with the home. Not only did IBM Global Services in those days give maternity leave, they also gave paternity leave. And interesting enough, those benefits actually stacked up really nicely against one of the best countries in the world on this, which is Sweden. Now, I think the benefits package is slowing down. I'm not sure what's going on, but the workplace has become rather unfriendly to the balance of people want to have families. People want to be able to have a little bit of flexible time so that they can go to the kids' soccer game or go to their kids' recital and things like that. So I think America has gotten so wrapped up in the bottom line that they keep forgetting that they're losing their talent. The University of Hawaii actually has been losing a ton of talent, and I think some of it might be because of the flexibility. R. Campbell, yeah, I agree. Maternity leave and paternity leave are required by law, but back in the day when I was doing a lot of interviewing, the benefits were way better than what was required by the law. And corporations like HP and IBM and Google and so forth were trying really, really hard to make their corporations as family-friendly as possible. HP at their Beaverton plant in Oregon actually went as far as having a on-site daycare to handle, kids. Employee kids. What happened, America? We're seeing less and less of this. We're seeing more and more corporations expecting huge amounts of overtime and taking away from the family. And this is bad. We're going to keep losing talent. Just look at those numbers from how many women are leaving at the mid-level in their careers because they can't get a balance. And I'm sorry, even though right now there's actually more women than men in America, or, depending on whose set of statistics you look at, let's just assume 50-50. That means we're potentially losing half of the talent, half of the intellectual talent in America. Come on, employers. We as human beings like to have families. We need a balance. And I think we need to pay a lot more attention to saying, hey, we're in an intellectual property-driven economy, or at least our industry is, and there's nothing, absolutely nothing, that says women have less ideas than men. So I think we as Americans and employers need to do something about making this a lot more even and paying attention to the needs of the families so that we can keep the talent in our house.
That's right. I think you called out a couple points too. I think there's, you know, a lot of people are just afraid. I think R. Campbell in the chat room actually brought it out as, you know, people are workaholics. And so they tend to worry about taking leave or taking vacation, taking parental leave, taking vacation, being with the family, because they tend to worry about the fact that they maybe get behind, or, you know, they'll get left out, or they'll get things, you know, have things change underneath the covers. There's several examples in the article that we pointed out today that, you know, people are saying, hey, you know, I went on vacation or parental leave. When I came back, my team was different, or, you know, my accounts were gone or something like that. And I guess these types of things are constantly happening. And so, again, it creates the fear in people that, you know what, just stay at work. Don't go away, because they're going to end up changing something on you. And I just think that these types of patterns need to change. Companies need to have a forcing function to move into a different direction. These types of things. You know, also interesting note about the fact that I think you noted here is that IBM is kind of moving away from the kind of remote worker sense. You know, we don't want these telem workers up anymore. We want people in the office on site. Now, you know, at Microsoft, we don't, you know, where I work, you know, they don't require that. You can work from home if you need to. It's pretty flexible. As long as you get your project done, you hit your milestones and your dates and at the high quality bar. But there are companies, like we said, IBM is trying to move in the opposite direction. Cheaper, do you think that this is just a better pattern to have, to move in that direction, so that more people are in work, they're FaceTime, they're basically involved, and they're less opportunity to kind of change things under the covers for them?
Yeah, I'm always of the opinion that there needs to be a balance. You know, I have some cases where I need to work from home. I want that option. It is a benefit. And if we start getting benefits taken away from us, you know, are we going to leave? Are we going to lose the talent? You know, there are organizations that are, you know, really good. They actually say, hey, you know, you are going to lose your vacation. We want you to take vacation. We want you to lower your stress levels. Stimpy Cat. Yeah, I agree. I work at a university of 30,000 students. That's Stimpy Cat. But the HR is in the 1950s. I agree. We need to have a balance. There's been some wild talk about going to a four-day work week. I don't know. But we need a balance. If we're going to be able to compete globally, we can't afford to lose talent. And talent goes where they're comfortable. I'm actually thinking really, really hard, because I've got a manager that's driving me out of my mind. And I'm thinking I'm going to retire when I first can retire. I might pull the ripcord and just be a full-time journalist again, because it's just not as much fun to work here anymore. And, you know, this university, I'm sorry, Stimpy Cat, our university is in the 1950s also.
That's right. Yeah, I think that, again, these types of reports that we're seeing, you know, women standing up and families standing up about specific issues that are happening, it's going to be a forcing function for corporate world to start moving in a different direction. I think we'll start seeing those trends, hopefully. All right, folks, that does it to that bite. But, you know, let's move on to the next bite. We have another interesting topic. Since Twight kind of keeps up in the latest enterprise news, and we keep reporting this week after week, around the Infinity crypto flaws, and it seems that the flaw is finally reached farther into the industry. How far? Well, the vulnerability now exposes smart cards, security tokens, TPM chips, Wi-Fi, and other secure hardware chips made by Infineon. At first, it was just a flaw in the chip, but now there's an attack that actually happened due to the flaw, dubbed a factorization attack by the Center for Research of Cryptography. It would be feasible for a hacker to compute the private part of an encryption key using only the key's public part. The researchers, led by Petr Zvenda, I'm not going to even pronounce that right, of Masaryk University in Czech Republic, found that this issue can actually be very easy. The flaw resided in the crypto library used by Infineon within an algorithm that is used to generate large prime numbers, which are then paired. Infineon used a simplified system for generating these prime numbers called FastPrime that had been officially certified, but no mathematical weaknesses were found during the certification process, the company said. So this crippling flaw in the widely used code library has fatally undermined the security of millions of encryption keys it used in the highest stakes settings, including national identity cards, software and application signing, and TPM or trusted platform modules protecting government and corporate computers. So the weakness also allows attackers to calculate the private portion of any vulnerable key using the nothing more than a corresponding public portion. Hackers can then use the private key to impersonate key owners, decrypt sensitive data, sneak malicious code and digitally signed software, and bypass protections that prevent accessing or tampering with stolen PCs. The five-year-old flaw is also troubling because it's located in code that complies with two internationally recognized security certification standards that are binding on many government contractors, companies worldwide. The flaw left 750,000 digital identity cards issued by Estonia's vulnerable to attack, the government of the East European country that has been pioneered of e-government since last month. This past week, Estonian authorities said they're taking preventative measures to fix it. Other companies like Microsoft included are updating firmware that runs on Infineon's so-called trusted platform modules to address the security flaws in the release patches. But there's also many other companies that are also putting out patches as well. So, Chibert, is this just proof that, you know, we need to continue to do kind of these edge type testing where we just need to pound even some of the certifications that are out there around security to see if we find flaws? I mean, this security research firm is finding these things. Google is finding these things. Do we need to do more of this so we can make sure that we harden the certifications and things that are out there today? Or what's the fix for this?
I totally agree. We need organizations. We need young talent like JJ in the chat room that's willing to go and pound on these things and find the flaws. You know, the reality is the algorithm itself isn't flawed. You know, the entire algorithm. What's flawed is basically the quick prime portion. How I don't want to call it a shortcut because it really wasn't. It is a faster way of creating large prime numbers, which is absolutely essential as part of the crypto process. The reality is we're all human. You know, coders are human. When you start talking about millions or tens of millions of lines of code, especially when you're starting to talk about code that has to be really optimized, because nobody wants to take, you know, wait 10 minutes for an SSL encrypted web page to load. That's just unreasonable. So we need it fast. We want it fast as a consumer, but there's some compromises. And the quick prime was one of those compromises. So yeah, we need testing. We need more talent. We need more universities, like say JG was talking about Augusta. In fact, sorry, I forgot to put the announcement. Augusta's master's program in cybersecurity got approved by their board of regents. Woohoo! We need organizations like that to go and keep, you know, the extra set of eyes, more eyes on the problem to find the issues, help fix them before they get onto the wild. And that's what I'm really happy about. This is not in the wild, quote, yet. It's been around a long time, but they haven't found, nobody's had documentation, or I haven't seen any documentation about a hack that utilizes this out in the wild yet. So good, we've got time to fix. I've gotten tons of emails from Wi-Fi vendors, even from Apple, saying, we know about crack. We know about this. We're fixing it. You know, Apple's going to be releasing another version of iOS very, very quickly. It's going to fix the crack vulnerability on the client side. Most of the Wi-Fi vendors have all released patches already. I got to imagine what they're doing is they're bypassing the quick prime and they're going and using a longer method to calculate the primes. You know, heck, you know, primes and random numbers are the bread and butter. You know, I love what Silicon Graphics did. I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, they actually had a webcam pointed at a bank of lava lamps to generate random numbers. That was very cool. Anyway, yeah, It can be fixed. We need more eyes on it. That's my rant.
I think another thing I'm wondering about, I don't see a lot of this actually, is the fact that companies are not putting out, you know, bug bounties like they did before. You know, like for instance, you hear a lot about hackathons and they're just like essentially codeathons where people come in and just write some code and maybe build some new features. You know, and Netflix and other companies, they put out these rewards for, you know, figuring out and on making their algorithms better. But what we don't hear a lot about is, you know, spending time breaking apart and giving a bounty for, you know, finding flaws in standards and certification and security. And you'd think that companies would want more and more now that we hear more and more in the wild about all of these reports about flaws and exploits. And so I'm wondering if is that something that you'll see that would be a good thing for students to start doing is start looking into maybe having these kind of competitions and then reporting back to corporations and maybe other people who are developing the standards.
Yeah. The reality is, you know, I'm sorry. The bottom line is a lot of this probing is expensive. So Mu Dynamics sadly got bought. They actually had an automated way, you know, some appliance that allow you to go and run the library of cert attacks. And then it would also fuzz those attacks to see how well devices could handle, you know, 0 day. Very, very cool. It made it a lot more affordable to do testing. We need things like that. We need toolkits and so forth. You know, I think it's time to go have Mudge on. You know, Raphael Mudge did has a great toolkit on doing penetration testing. I think that's the bottom line. More people need to learn how to do this so that we can drive the price down so it becomes affordable, because the bean counters aren't going to do it unless it's affordable. And, you know, that's why one of the things I was trying to do is I was actually trying to get a grant from NIST to spin up an institute that just does this type of stuff, you know, an underwriter laboratory for security devices. Oh, what a concept. So, yeah, I think we need some things changing. I think we need more talent. I think we need more people. And you know what? We've got a guest that actually does something just like that. And, you know, Lou, what do you think? You think it's time to go and introduce our guest?
I definitely think it's time. And in fact, you know, one last quote is, you know, I think it's actually always cheaper to find a threat until after the threat. So I think, you know, putting that extra effort into finding it up front, I think is definitely worth it. But like Cheaper said, it comes to my favorite part of the show where we get to bring in an expert in the field to talk shop and drop some knowledge on the Twiat Riot. And this week is no exception. He's a principal thread researcher evangelist at F5 Labs with over 20 years of experience in internet security, Mr. Ray Pompom. Welcome to Twiat.
Hello. Good to be here.
Thanks, Ray. Thanks for coming. We appreciate you. We like having you here. Can you tell us a little bit about F5 Networks? What is it? What does it do?
F5 Labs is the threat research division of F5. So F5labs.com, we have a ton of research available up there, as well as some CISO to CISO articles, which is what other CISOs are doing to secure their things, or, you know, ideas around compliance or architecture. We have a bunch of different reports available. A recent report we talked earlier about IoT security. We have a huge report on IoT and DDoS trends that's real fascinating reading from some of our threat researchers. And my specialty is application security. So we have a lot of interesting things around web applications, and that's of course what F5 does, is we make apps go securely. So there's a lot of stuff on there. Just go to f5labs.com and take a read around. It's all free. And literally like 100 articles, and they're being updated constantly.
There's some good content. I love reading through the blogs out there, keeping myself up to date. But there was one particular tech. Now, I think Kevin showed that blog there about phishing and how it's on the rise. We've all been kind of subjected to phishing campaign attacks at one point or another. So maybe you can go through what kinds of phishings are there and what kinds of tricks that the attackers are now using in these types of phishing campaigns.
Sure. So one of the things that we have now is people are far more connected in social media. And so, you know, there's the two kinds of phishing. There's the spray and pray, where they just, you know, pass things down. And I think we've been seeing that over the past 20 years. And then with spear phishing, where people are actually being targeted. Well, when we're spraying things all over social media, it becomes much, much easier to start to target people. You can start by looking at a company, seeing, you know, going onto LinkedIn and various sites and seeing who works at that company, and then start looking up their Facebook profiles. And yeah, here you can see in the article, you can actually pull together quite an interesting dossier about someone, what their interests are. And you can use that, and as well as impersonate their friends, to craft phishing emails that are far more likely to be clicked on. Because it comes, you know, when we do phishing training, it's always like, don't click on links from people you don't know. Don't click on links that are spelled badly. Well, you know, now you can have the ability to create links that look like they come from people you know. You create an email, you know, profile that looks like just like somebody you know, and you mention some things that you're interested in, and hey, click this or run this video or download this, and boom, you're getting pulled into something.
Right.
Oh yeah, you can see some of the materials here.
Right. So this is the interesting part. So they're basically using touch points on the web to collect data about particular people. And then they're essentially using this data to then kind of make things more personal. Is that essentially what they're doing?
Yeah. Yeah. It gets to be, you know, you go from spear phishing to like laser targeted. And, you know, since it's not just, you know, certain people, I mean, you know, if you're targeting an organization, I'm sure you could find easily dozens, if not hundreds of people within that organization that you could target and build a profile on, again, just one click. And then that's your footprint into a company. And then from there, you can start moving around. And yeah, you can see sorry.
No, that's okay. My one question was just, you know, what can people do to protect themselves from this? I mean, there's so many touch points on the web that are collecting information now. What is the best way to prevent this from happening? I mean, obviously, if the information is out there, people could potentially use it for maliciously. So what's the workaround here?
Well, one thing to do is, if you're a security person, is to be aware of what your social footprint looks like for your organization. It's sort of like, you know, do this analysis on your organization, see how much of it is out there. It's something I used to do when I was a CISO, is just try to look at like how much of my organization is visible, what's the footprint on the web. And it gives me an idea. There are some organizations that actually are doing threat intelligence research where they're watching their websites, and you'll see things where, hey, you know, we just announced this particular new product, and there's all these on our website coming from this Asian country. Well, okay, on that website, what particular researchers were mentioned? Now we know that those researchers may be targeted for phishing attacks to try to steal intellectual property. And so you can do it the same way, just like the fishers are laser targeting, you can do laser targeted warning of your users saying, hey, your stuff is out there, you may be targeted. From an end user point of view, what you can do, it's a simple matter of think before you click. When you get something, you know, don't just like, you know, click straight on it. Just stop a minute and think about it. A lot of times, you know, these phishing things, they come with some sort of link as well. Like, hey, go here, click this, click that. The thing to do is not to actually click the link, but to go directly to a site. Like, hey, go click here on bankofwakanda.com. Well, go to an URL and type in www.bankofwakanda.com. Don't click the actual link. So it's a matter of, you know, sort of breaking the thinking that people have where, you know, it's that natural cycle of like, oh, I got this and I'm just going to do this and click this and do that. But to stop and think before you act.
So, Ray, this is really sounding like one of the things we really need to concentrate on is user education. But the question I have is, you know, there's always going to be that one person. Just one is going to click on that stupid link. Do you think this is something we're just going to have to live with and hope the next generation is better educated about this? And do we think we need to start investing more in security education, maybe at the K through 12 level? What do you think about that?
Well, so, you know, education, I definitely believe in education, and I like to make people aware of the actual threat. So when I do security awareness training, I actually walk them through this exercise so they fully understand what's going on. Instead of just saying, don't click links, but say, like, look, this is how the bad guys do it. They can actually go register a domain that looks just like something you're used to. And so that you're building the full understanding. That said, it is hard to to, you know, fully educate people, because the thing to remember is the bad guys are actively trying to trick us. They're con men. They're working psychologically to overcome all these things we're doing. It's not just like, oh, we go to dumb, click the link. It's like, hey, they're being tricked. They're working to try to, you know, figure out how to work inside their mind and use all these things, you know, their friends' names and things like that. So I think there definitely is a limit to education, especially as long as this gets to be an arms race. And I think that's something where you can look back as you know, your security designers and go, okay, somebody is going to click that link, like you said. So what's going to happen? What can I do? Maybe this is, you know, a way to move the toilet. There's a shout out to this podcast. Maybe you can move to saying, okay, this is why we're going to implement two-factor across the board. So if some phishing guy steals your credentials, we at least can limit the damage. Maybe we look at segregation of duties. And so, like, system administrators can't be, you know, essentially in email with their full administrative credentials, but they have a separate account when they're doing the administrative work. So if their accounts do get popped, they're not going to take out the entire organization. So, you know, definitely I think it's a holistic approach where I think education is part of it, but there's a lot more.
Hey, Ray, we had a guest on not too terribly long ago. It basically was a whole bunch of virtual machines, you know, one-time use virtual machines that people would use to browse the net so that if they did click on something bad, at least it was, quote, a disposable machine. I haven't seen it as a trend, really, but do you think maybe that's something we need to start looking at, disposable virtual machines?
So I actually know some security research. That's how they actually do most of their work. I have some friends who, well, I can describe a very convoluted setup that involves several virtual machines handed off from a distance that they RDP to to do their surfing. They're that paranoid. And some of the work that threat researchers do, it makes sense. Sort of commoditizing that for the basic user, that'll be an interesting thing, because I think, you know, like you were talking earlier about the SSL pages and Recon, you know, is your basic user deal with that? Are they going to be able to deal with the overhead of a virtual machine on top of that if, you know, their fancy 3D web graphics aren't loading as fast as they can? But I think, you know, the browser manufacturers are working to do more sandboxing and more segregation to try to prevent some of that stuff. But it's always been an arms race, and I think it'll continue to be.
Right. So, Ray, another interesting thing that I'm starting to see a trend is in some of the high profile companies out there. You hear a little bit about internal campaigns where they actually will, you know, legitimately send some phishing emails to their users and run them through kind of a training program of when they click on something, something bad happens. Is this something that you're seeing in the industry as a trend? So it's essentially kind of scaring the bejesus out of their users so that they essentially can train them in the right direction?
Right. And that's, I think, a better way to think of it than scaring the bejesus out of it. But it becomes sort of a holistic thing, again, where it's not just we're gonna do training, but we're also going to look at a full picture. And not just like, hey, we're phishing once a year, once a quarter, but it would be an ongoing campaign throughout the year where you're sort of, you know, randomly phishing people throughout the organization. And when they obviously, you know, click on the link, you then would send them a reminder and maybe give them additional training. So you're looking at more of sort of a behavioral mod and slowly trying to move people back. And at the same time, the security people are getting feedback about how phishable their organization is. Like I talked earlier about threat intelligence and getting an idea about, you know, where your weak spots are and where you need to worry. So if, you know, half your organization are clicking on links, then you know that you really need to do something about segregation of duties and more internal firewall. Right. And maybe better training. So, you know, I think it's a good thing, and I think it's going to provide another tool in the toolbox that CISOs can use to try to fix things. Oh, yeah, there's the IoT report. Those are the thoughts. So, yeah, we had a lot of fun with those. Hopefully that'll be a noise from F5. I'm just going to put that one out.
one of the other things you called out in some of the blog posts is the fact that organizations are potentially leaking information. So obviously there's tools like LexisNexis where you can essentially get information about an organization, and essentially even email addresses of executives and financial information and more. Right. But the actual organizations themselves are leaking information to the wild in specific instances. What kind of information are you seeing them leak, and how are they doing it?
It's been the wide gamut. A lot of it you see, you know, on social media sites like LinkedIn and things like that, where people are talking about internal projects. And you know, the big thing too is like, you know, you want to target the organization, you find out who works there, and then you start pulling their personal information and using that to do a phish. So, you know, it's a little bit of both. Another simple attack is just to pull all the DNS from a company and look at the entire footprint that they have out there. And sometimes DNS, you can get ideas, project name, and new servers that are coming up. And that also can feed into your scams and your ideas. And then also business partners. You see press releases about, hey, we're working with this business partner and things like that. So it gives you a chance of starting sending, you know, fake dinner bills. And hey, I'm, you know, the sales guy with so-and-so, and I need to change some account information. And, you know, those are all kind of typical phishing scam things that come in.
Got it. And then one of the interesting things I saw was you were saying a little bit about how, you know, email, and when people send their emails, they can actually inspect their email header information and get a little bit more about their network internally as well.
Yeah. And that's been true from the olden days. Just depending on how email has been configured, you know, you can pull out internal IP addresses, internal name servers and things like that. And that's usually considered not, you know, hey, that's just minor information leakage, you know, and then, but it all adds up and help build a story. And actually, you point about another defense there, because I have seen this now being used in a lot of organizations, is the mail servers can be configured to tell you if email is coming from an external source or internal source. So you actually have a marking in email itself, and I believe this is even an exchange setting, that says external email, which can help when some of these phishing scams pretend to be an internal resource or pretend to be something that's inside the organization, at least prominently in the email. But hey, external, maybe you shouldn't trust it that much.
Right. So before we run out of time, I did want to give you a chance. I'm curious to hear about some of the new trends that are kind of floating along with phishing attacks. Like, I know we've heard the old age-old thing of, you know, get an email, you get a link. You said a little bit about how they're using information about the user and kind of making it more personal. You know, what are some of the other things that you're seeing, and are they more around psychological things? Are they more around, you know, hitting it more personal, more home, that kind of thing, in order to get people to click the links?
Actually, what you see is more business focus. I mean, this is a job. Phishing is a job, and they get rewarded for it. They get paid. And so all the things that we do now in the tech industry and in the marketing industry, they are starting to adopt. That's like A-B testing. Hey, let's try this fish versus that fish. Which one is more successful? They start honing their message, using marketing databases and marketing techniques, using spell checkers and grammar checkers, using more, you know, better written messages, starting to use more, psychological hooks, the kind of things you see in scams. So there's a lot more thought put into it. There's, you know, as you say, there's big reward. So people are working actively to get better at phishing, and it's usually something that's very successful. So, you know, if you were looking to break into hacking, this is, it's a good place to start, because you don't require a whole lot of technical knowledge, and then you can kind of work your way up through the system this way.
Right. Fantastic. Well, unfortunately, we've actually run out of time. And folks, you've done it again. You used up another hour of the best staying enterprise show on, according to 9 out of 10 phishing scams. Of course, I do want to thank our guest for today for dropping some knowledge on the Twit Riot, Ray Pompom, from a principal threat researcher from F5 Networks. Thank you so much for coming to the show. Can you tell us a little bit about where they can find you, your work, and a little bit about F5 Labs?
F5labs.com. We have new material up every week, and more interesting reports come out on a regular basis. So check us out.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Ray, for coming. We really do appreciate it. Of course, I got to thank my co-host in crime. I couldn't do this show without you. I wouldn't want to do the show without you, Mr. Brian Chi. Can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and your work?
Yeah. Go to www.clickmefirst.com. Woohoo! Yeah. Anyway, I'm ADVNETLAB on Twitter, and I'm also Chibert at twit.tv. Now we have a Flipboard magazine. Just search for Twiet Riot, two words. And if you would like to think about contributing on using that as a way to tell us, you know, give us suggestions on topics, just email me and we'll see if we can add you onto the magazine. It is a grand experiment. And thanks again to Denise Howell for suggesting it.
Fantastic. Thank you, Chibert. And of course, folks, we have to also thank you. You tune in each and every week. We wouldn't want to do the show without you, and we couldn't do the show without you. And we want you to make it easy. We want to make it easier for you to subscribe to the show and watch the show. And so just go out right now to twit.tv/Twiet. There you can find all of our back episodes, as well as full show links and stories, and as well as names of our guests and show notes. It's very useful information. Also, that important button to the right there where it lets you subscribe to any format of your choice, both audio and video, HD video, and to the device of your choice, both phone, tablet, laptop, desktop. Also, don't be afraid to share Twiet with your friends and family. We all want to know about what's going on in the enterprise, and this is definitely the show for it. Remember, we also do this show live each and every week on Friday at 1:30 Pacific time. So come and watch us live at live.twit.tv. And of course, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well come and jump in the chat room live as well as irc.twit.tv, where we each and every week we have a pretty great discussion. We have some great people that show up there. And in fact, they ask some great questions and then sometimes veer the show in different directions. Of course, you can also don't forget to follow me on Twitter at LouMM. We can find all the things I'm working on. Also, you want to go ahead and check out dev.office.com of all my work. Before we go, though, I also want to thank everyone who makes the show possible, especially Leo and Lisa, who support us each and every week for doing This Week in Enterprise Tech. And thank you to all the engineers at Twit that make this show possible. And of course, thank you to our tireless producer, Mr. Brian Chi. And of course, thank you to our TD, Kevin. Kevin, can you tell the folks at home what it is that you do at Twit here?
Oh, I eat everyone else's birthday cakes. When they have birthdays.
I think I want that job.
Hey, when we hit our 300th episode, I've asked for cake.
Fantastic.
All right.
And, since Lou and I aren't in the studio, someone's going to have to eat it, right?
Padre.
Kevin's our man.
Padre, right. Too. I got to compete with him.
Yeah. So, Kevin, when we hit our 300th episode, what flavor cake should I order?
Chocolate with raspberry filling.
Ding, ding, right ding, on. Ding, ding. Winner. All right. Well, thanks, Kevin. And of course, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca. And just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiet.